Welcome to The Journey 8. I'm Reverend Judy Hosner, and I invite you to sit back and spend a few moments with us as we share some music and dialogue with you. All right, that was Sandy Patty with a very, very popular song for this season called Via Della Rosa, and I hope you enjoyed it. I am Reverend Judy Hosner. Tonight, tomorrow, who knows? oh, we're starting already! Oh, gee! And my co-host is Robin Hood, and...
Also known as Ryan Duncan, and it's good to be with you tonight.
So, laughter aside, today we finished the story of Passion Week, and our next show will be what happened during Eastertide, what happened after Jesus arose and rolled away the stone. Who did he see? What did he do? What did he eat? I don't think he ate anything, did he?
He may have had some fish.
Go fish.
Not sure. But we can discuss all that and discuss why it's important to us.
Yes.
Today.
So that's kind of how we've segregated it out or sectioned it out, because it's so much information and we didn't want to try and cram it into 1 hour. Because we fight to keep you awake as it is.
Well, and more importantly, we're not trying to give you information. We want to share with you a story so that you're inspired enough with it to go look in the Gospels yourself. Because there are different stories in the different Gospels. Some are fairly close and some are not. So since this is Holy Week, I would invite you, as part of your spiritual practice, to pick up the Bible and look at the Gospels and read one of the stories all the way through so you can get Jesus's birth and his death, because I think they're both important, but we often read them as being separate things because we have Christmas and we have Easter, and I think it makes much more sense when you read the whole story together.
Absolutely. It would be like reading a biography of anyone, and halfway through, set the book down and say, ah, that was so nice. And I am, of course, being a progressive Christian, not one who likes to just pick and choose pieces of any story and say, this is it, you know, and this is what you should believe. We, Ryan and I especially believe that it is not our place to tell you what to believe. It's our place to give you information.
That's right.
That's right. That's the good answer.
We invite you into dialogue.
So here we are on August. Whoa, a little ahead of my time there, April 10th. And we're going to pick up where we left off at the last show, which is right after Jesus cleansed the temple of all the money changers and evil people and zapped that poor little fig tree.
The poor fig tree.
Poor fig tree.
The fig tree did nothing wrong.
Well, it did not have fruit for Jesus, and he was hungry.
And whose fault was that?
And so, you know, it's part of his grieving process. I am glad I am not a fig tree. I eat figs. Does that count?
No.
So we're up to the point where Ryan is going to talk about the Great Commandment.
The Great Commandment. So the great commandment can be found in Mark in chapter 12, verses 28 to 34. And I like to give you the chapters and all so that you can know where to find it, because there are different versions in the different stories. So I'm using Mark. And the great commandment is when a scribe went to Jesus and asked him, "What's the greatest commandment?" And Jesus said, "It's to love the Lord with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. The second commandment is love your neighbor as yourself." And then he goes on to say that sacrifices and leaving money at the temple is not what's important. These two things are important. So this is a new paradigm shift away from leaving sacrifices and offerings at the temple. And instead, the great commandment is saying that the best way for you to love Jesus is to love your fellow man. And it's very simple and it's very life-changing. And this is, though oftentimes people don't think of this in terms of Easter as being part of the narrative, it really is at the core of what is happening, at least metaphysically and theologically. And then after the great commandment, also in Mark in 13, 1 and 2, Jesus predicts the destruction of the temple. And this gets Jesus in some trouble later, as you'll see. But he's leaving the temple one day, and somebody says something about all the great big stones in the temple. And Jesus says that none of the stones are going to be left, that the entire temple is going to be thrown down and nothing will be left of it. And later in the story, he gets in trouble for declaring that he has the power to destroy the temple and will rebuild it in 3 days. But you see in this verse that that's not really what he said. He's predicting that that will happen. And that sort of comes true. And he pays for that later, their misunderstanding of what he's just said.
And I'm not sure, even after Christ's death, that they got it.
No, I don't think so. And that's kind of the point. I think that this story shows us that there are oftentimes the disciples also where Jesus has a teaching and then we don't get it.
Yeah, and I think when you're listening to some of the parables and stories that he tells that he has to turn around, you know, it's kind of like when you tell a joke and then you've got to explain it. It takes right. all the fun. Well, I think that's how Jesus was feeling sometimes with his own disciples. You know, I said this and you got, you know, deer in the headlights kind of look. So let me explain to you, you know. And the statement about the temple being torn down was very controversial because people are taking it literally.
Yes.
The temple is the center of their day, you know, their world, and this man is talking about tearing it down to the ground.
Well, that's exactly right. It's the center of the world. God lives in the temple. God is there. You can only, therefore, make sacrifices to the temple. This was before synagogues were a thing. Everything happened in the temple in Jerusalem. So to say that was going to be destroyed means that's the eradication of their entire faith. And when the temple is destroyed, we see that is true. And their faith and their practices have to change because they don't have the temple to worship in.
Right. The temple was the original grandfather, shall we say, of what we know today as synagogues. But it was even more than that because allegedly the Ark of the Covenant was in the temple in Jerusalem. And, oh boy, you know, Ten Commandments laying inside this extravagantly decorated box, basically. And so when word got out that this happened, what happened to the people?
Are you asking me?
Yeah, I am. Come on. Get on your donkey and ride.
Oh, my goodness. You just called me out. And I don't know the answer. Well, how embarrassing.
You kind of broached on it. And I'm going to tell everybody, this is the beginning of the people starting to uprise against Christ. You know, you had the betrayal between Judas and the high chiefs and Sadducees, but that wasn't the people. But when Christ made this statement about the temple, it was a command moment. It was the moment that people started saying, this man is not real. How could he say he's going to tear down the temple and build it back in 3 days?
Well, not only did they say that he's not real, but the leaders, the elders, all were now threatened, because if they didn't have the temple, then their role as priests were going to be invalid, because there'd be nothing for them to do without the temple. So, yeah. And the way I read it is that's foreshadowing of what's about to happen, and that the temple is destroyed, and then God goes out of the temple and is in the world. In a much larger way than he is current or back at that time. And that's a really powerful thing for the people to know that God is now with them always, not just living in the temple. And yet that's the threat that the clergy have and that the institutional church has.
Right.
And we see that play out today as well.
I was going to ask that.
So yes, this doesn't seem like it's very important, but it really, really is, the destruction of the temple, because it means God has now left the building.
Elvis and God have left the building. So, you know, this is all happening to give you a timeline of the Passion Week. Jesus came in on Sunday, you know, with Hosanna and palms flying and, you know, donkeys wondering what the hen fat's going on. And, everybody was joyous and, oh, you know, and Monday, the very next day, he digs himself a hole already, you know, it starts. There is no time warp. You know, Monday was basically, you know, cursing the poor little fig tree and cleansing the temple because he was angry. He started out being angry because the tree wouldn't feed him. By the time he got to the temple and saw all the money changers and everything, he just went freak out. And it's the only time in the Bible that you have a story where Jesus lost control. Never did the rest of the week while he was being tortured. Never did beforehand when people were kind of rough with him. This is the only part of the scripture, the only time that he lost control. And so being fully human and fully divine, he did a great job.
Yeah, I mean, when he loses his cool, he loses it in grand fashion. I give him
yes,
that.
I would say, run! Run and hide. All right.
We need to continue on with this story. That's we'll never finish it.
So where are we? We are now coming into Wednesday and Thursday. And, of course, in the timeline of that period, they're getting ready for the Passover dinner. And so a lot of things are happening. You know, people are cleaning their houses and getting the tables all set and so on and so forth. But the important thing that happens on Wednesday is that all four of the Gospels have this account of the plot to kill Jesus. Now it's real. Now it's Judas standing in front of the chief priests and money being exchanged, a contract was made. And so it's an important element to the story, and it is the only thing, really, that is mentioned on Wednesday. Then you move into what we call Monday Thursday, and this is where I think it gets kind of interesting, don't you?
It does, yes.
So the Passover preparations have been made, and if you know anybody today that is Jewish, they celebrate Passover exactly the same way, especially the Orthodox Jews, that it was celebrated 2,000 years ago. And so the table's all set, and the women are bringing the food to the table. Jesus comes, and I think we talked about this briefly last week. Jesus comes to sit down, but instead takes his outer robes off, and grabs some towels and begins to wash the feet of all the disciples. Now, it had to be an odd thing. Let's see how we can put it in today's context. You're sitting at a Thanksgiving dinner with all of your parents and grandparents and all these important people in your life. And all of a sudden, you start washing everyone's feet. And it was a symbol of humility and a symbol of love. So the disciples were kind of confused. But after he got to about the fifth person, it sank in what he was trying to do. So during that time, everybody's kind of quiet. They're just kind of talking a little bit. He finishes washing everyone's feet and gets himself, you know, dressed, washes his hands and everything, gets back to the table, Passover table, and they begin their service. And this is exactly at sunset during supper. And this is where Jesus foretells his betrayal. And I wish I were a fly on the wall during that moment, because it had to have been mind-blowing. He foretells his betrayal. And of course, Peter's the first one who pops up, you know, Peter, it's Mr. Foot in the Mouth, and says, "What are you talking about?" You know, and of course says, "Is it me?" And Jesus says, "No." And so on and so forth. Then Judas makes the stupidest mistake a betrayer can make and says, "Is it I, Lord?" And of course, Jesus says, "You have said so." So it's like, I'm not going to say yes, but you're the one who just confessed who you are. And so they kind of settled down for that. And this is where Ryan comes in, right?
That's right. And I would like to note that I didn't know that part of the story. I had never heard it because I'm not a big fan of John. And you can find Judas confessing in John. It's one of those weird little elements that a lot of people don't necessarily know about because they follow a certain book's story and that narrative. And so it's kind of interesting to look at different ones because you get different things like that in it, which are really interesting. I want to talk a little bit more about the Last Supper, and I'm using the book of Mark. It's chapter 14. And what's interesting is that you have this big bombshell happen, and they're sitting there among a traitor, and they continue to eat. They still don't lose fellowship with each other. They continue. And I find that really fascinating. Really, 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 really fascinating. And then the next thing that happens after that is the new commandment. And that's in John chapter 13. And Jesus, on announcing his imminent death, declares a new commandment. And he says, love one another as I've loved you. This is how, and so this is how they as people are to identify themselves and how they're to be known, through loving people, not through circumcision, not through having a particular diet, and not through following all these laws that you find in Deuteronomy, but by loving one another. And that's the new law that Jesus brings with him. And it's one of the reasons why we celebrate Easter, because Jesus brought love with him instead of all these legalistic things that you have to follow. And that changed the way that people lived, because they weren't concerned with making God happy by giving offerings and giving money and stuff. They were concerned about making God happy by loving each other. And that's a very big paradigm change to have happen. And that's what Jesus did.
Yeah, and it's, we refer to it, of course, as the good news. And that before Christ came, there were the laws, like Batman said. And
you just have to.
You got promoted.
I'm Batman, I'm Robin, I'm all kinds of people.
And so what happens when Jesus first announces the great commandment, which is love yourself and love everyone else, that commandment, of course, is Old Testament, live this way. The new commandment that he's just talking about is now a direct, I don't want to say order, but a direct statement. You know, people are going to know who you are by the way you live and by the way you act.
Right. And I think this here is the beginnings of where Christians become separate from Jews.
That's right.
Right here. Before that, everybody were Jewish, or they were Christian Jews. They were still just a sect within Judaism. It's here in this moment that that separation happens.
Absolutely. So you're going to go on and talk about, I have it that you're going to talk about hearts.
Am I?
I don't know.
So
see how prepared we are. We have so much fun that we forget during our workshop day to study about what we're going to say. I don't know. We just pull it from the Bible and we go.
Well, see, I think you think I'm supposed to say something that I'm not. So I'm talking about the gift of peace, which can be found in John, and it's chapter 14. And because I like it so much, I'm going to read it directly from John instead of paraphrasing.
Okay.
I have said these things to you while I am still with you. But the Advocate, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, will teach you everything and remind you of all that I have said to you. Peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you. I do not give to you as the world gives. Do not let your heart be troubled, and do not let them be afraid. You heard me say to you, I am going away and I am coming to you. If you loved me, you would rejoice that I am going to the Father, because the Father is greater than I. And now I have told you this before it occurs, so that when it does occur, you may believe. I will no longer talk much with you, for the ruler of this world is coming. He has no power over me, but I do as the Father has commanded me, so that the world will know that I love the Father. Rise, let us be on our way. So even here at the end, Jesus is saying that the authorities are coming for me, and they're going to take me, and I'm going to die. But don't be afraid, because I'm doing what God our Father has asked me to do. So go in faith. So he's basically telling everybody not to be afraid, that he knows what's going to happen, and it's all happening for the good, so you need to let it happen. It's interesting later that the disciples then are all, they're all afraid, and they all run away, because he's saying here not to be. Have faith in me and in God the Father that we know what we're doing and that something bad's going to happen, but it needs to happen.
Right. Yeah, I always found that interesting because Peter was the first one that popped up and said, they can kill me with you. I'm not going to leave you. And each one, you know, after that pipes in and says the same thing. But as soon as the ear of, what's his name? Malachus. Gets cut off, the disciples realize, uh-oh, we're in trouble. Let's run before the guards come and get us. So they disappear like a drop of ink in a glass of water. They're just gone, right? And so Jesus is standing there going, well, glad to see that you were going to stay with me to the end. But he knew that.
Yeah, right. He knew all that. But Jesus said at the beginning when the guards showed up, he said, I'm the one you're looking for. I'm Jesus. I confess it. Take me and leave these men alone. Right. So if they hadn't cut off the ear and done violence, they would have been fine.
They would have been.
But they didn't have faith, like God had just said, like Jesus just said, and so they got in trouble because they didn't have faith.
So this is all happening. This dialogue is all happening while they are going where?
They're getting ready to go to Golgotha. Is that what you're talking about? They're in Gethsemane.
Thank you for playing. I'm sorry.
I'll just say I didn't understand the question. Because once Jesus is arrested, they go to Golgotha. But
where they are right now, when they're talking about, you know, the gift of peace and the prophecy about I'm the one that they're going to come and get, they are actually on their way to the Garden of Gethsemane.
Oh, I thought they were already there.
Nope.
Okay.
No, they're walking there. And as they're walking, of course, Jesus tells them this stuff. And when they arrive at the garden, they kind of crowd Jesus a little bit. And so he grabs Peter and says, you know, stay here until I'm done. And he goes off about 20 feet or so and starts praying. And what ends up happening is they all fall asleep.
Right. He asked them to kind of stay watch and be guards, and they all fall asleep.
So Jesus goes off to pray. And of course, this is the famous, take this cup from me. I don't want to do this. I don't want to die. Eventually comes back and says, you know, not my will, but thy will be done. I think it's important timing that all these separate little incidents happen in the series that they happen, because if one of them were left out, the story would have a jagged piece of paper. In other words, you try to read this and there'd be holes in it, you know. And when people have to fill in, and I'm no different than anyone else, you make up stuff.
Right, yeah.
And when you make up stuff, it's not necessarily true, but what happens? Okay, I tell you, you tell your son, and then so on and so forth. So that's where we are. Jesus wakes them up, of course, and the whole time, Judas is still with them. He hasn't gone anywhere. He left briefly to make the deal, but it is at this point that he actually points out to Jesus, even though Jesus says, I'm the guy, and the betrayal happens, and he is arrested. Jesus, or Judas, disappears. And, of course, we know later on that he hung himself. But in this back-and-forth dialogue between the guards and Jesus and who's going to do what, Peter freaks out and cuts off is where he cuts off Malchus's ear. And they run. And actually, Jesus does not see them again.
That's
until
right.
After he's risen. They're gone. So, let's see. I think it's your turn, Mr. Wright? Or is it...
Do we want to go to a song, or...?
Oh, you know, we're about halfway. Can we do the second song, Mr. Engineer?
Calling and calling, nobody home. It feels like I'm falling alone. Out on an island, SOS on the beach. Watching your plane pass over me. How could you miss me with my hands in the air? I thought you were listening.
That was one of my favorite female Christian singers, Francesca Battistelli, from a lead song from the movie The Shack. I love this song because it reminds me so much of what Christ must have been thinking while he was laying there, kneeling there in the garden. Where were you, God? Where are you? And it's just a beautiful song. Ryan, where are you?
We're going to talk about the true vine.
Why can't I see you?
I don't know, but we can have this discussion later.
And I think we should.
So okay. The true vine is kind of a metaphor that Jesus brings up, and you can find this in John chapter 15. And Jesus says that he's a vine and God is a gardener, and that God prunes all the bad or those that are unbelievers and helps the good or believers to grow and bear more fruit. And that fruit glorifies God. And then he goes on to say, you can do nothing without God. So in a way, he's saying we as believers, as Christians, are part of the vine, which is Jesus. So we're embedded and wrapped around and intertwined with Jesus. And then God is kind of above us, working in our favor to help us grow and be more fruitful.
Mm-hmm.
So I find that rather compelling. I dislike the part about the pruning because I believe that everybody is part of God's family, and I don't believe that God would prune anybody off the vine. But that's my really progressive theology speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really all I have to say about that metaphor. It's really pretty if you feel like you're part of God's family, but if you're not, it can be problematic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of the things about that story or metaphor is that, like you said, if you are not living in God's light and you hear about this, pruning process, it's got to be that what goes through your mind is this ugly, he's going to cut my legs off, and then he's going to cut my arms off, to direct and physical instead of looking beyond and trying to see the actual story behind the story. But again, this plays a big part in the final day of Jesus's life, because he's trying to tell the disciples, listen, you are part of the vine, and you will carry on and be fruitful, even though I might be gone.
Right, but I think this metaphor is actually saying, in a spiritual way, Jesus isn't gone. We're all still very much wrapped up in him. And this is kind of the beginnings, I think, of Trinitarian kind of language that you see in the gospel. I'm not a big Trinitarian myself. But that's really what this metaphor is saying, that Jesus and God are two separate things working together for our benefit.
And I think I think it's a good thing to present different views, different understandings, especially of the triune, because there is a lot of misunderstanding or difference in what people feel or think about that. And it's good to talk about it, and we will on another show. So where are we at? We're down to the good part.
Yeah, we're getting down to it.
Okay, you got anything else to say? Or
I do not.
No!
It's shocking.
It is.
The good stuff.
I gotta go take my heart medicine. I mean, really? okay. Seriously, though. One of the things, we're at the point where Jesus has been arrested. That's just been arrested. And now the story really unfolds. Well, one of the things I love doing concerning his story is to record the number of times within 24 hours, actually less, Jesus is brought before somebody to be tried. And why it's so interesting to me is, like, all these people have this authority. So, you know, off you go to so-and-so. And we start right after the disciples take off. Jesus has been arrested. And where do they take him? Right before Aeneas. So that's number one hearing. Aeneas then says, whoa, this is like way too much for me. I'm going to turn you over what's the guy's name? Caiaphas. Help me.
Caiaphas,
I'm sorry. You know, that looked like an L, but it's an I. So he's struck out on number one hearing. Right after that is Peter's first denial. Remember, Peter has to deny him three times before he's sent to the Calvary. So first hearing, Peter's first denial, when somebody comes up to him in the street and says, aren't you with this guy that's being tried? And Peter says, nope, don't know the guy. That's really, think about it. So now he's drugged before Caiaphas, who's the high priest. Because here's one thing I want everyone to understand. It is not Rome that convicted and killed Jesus. And I think we've said this before. It is his own people. The Sadducees, Pharisees, the high priest. All these people, people that were part of his life. It wasn't Rome that came in and grabbed him and, you know, drug him off. It was the high priest, the guards for the high priest. So here we go. He's before Caiaphas now. And that's number two trial. Well, Caiaphas feels that he alone shouldn't make the decision about Jesus, that he should go before the Sanhedrin, which is like the general council. Okay. And so here comes Peter, in between that with his second denial. So that prophecy is starting to unfold, and the story starts following exactly what Jesus has been trying to tell them. So the Sanhedrin, which is like the general council, says, whoa, this is too much for us. They go ahead and order him in front of Pilate. So that's hearing number four, is his trial before Pilate. And of course, between the Sanhedrin and Pilate becomes Peter's third denial and the rooster crows. So it's early morning on Friday.
Yeah, and Peter weeps.
Because he knows that the prophecy has just been fulfilled.
And he knows that he failed.
That's right. So he's before Pilate now. Now he's in the care, I guess you could say, of the Romans. So all the way up to this time, the Romans have had nothing to do with his accusations and trials. That's all been the Jewish state, shall we say. So he's before Pilate, and Pilate says, I see nothing wrong with this guy. And so he says, what am I supposed to do with him? And back to the Sanhedrin he went. Well, of course, Judas in this time, this is where Judas commits suicide, because just as Peter realized he had fulfilled prophecy, Judas has realized that he's just killed Jesus Christ. And so he hangs himself. So back to the Sanhedrin, and here we go. They say, no, you've got to make a decision. So back to Pilate for the second time, which is trial number 5 now, 5 times. And no one could make up their mind. It's like, what do you think our justice system would be if judges kept playing ping pong with criminals? I mean, we have a set of rules where we appeal something, but just to send them back and forth. No, I don't want to hear this. Go over to Chicago. They'll listen to you. Craziness. So he's back in front of Pilate. And Pilate says, you know, really, this is not my area of authority. You fall under the authority of King Herod. That lovely person that likes to behead people. Okay, so trial number 6. He's standing in front of King Herod. And Herod says, don't want anything to do with it. I'm not sure this is really my business. Back to Pilate for the 3rd time, you go. So his 7th attempt to find some justice ends up in front of Pontius Pilate. And Pilate says, listen, the reason why I keep pushing him off is because I think he's innocent. In fact, I declare him innocent. And so then he says to the people, you have a choice to make. Barabbas, the known murderer and thief, or Jesus? And we all know what the answer was.
They were incited by the priests. It wasn't people acting on their own. They were incited by the priests.
And so this is a part of his crucifixion that makes me the saddest. Not the part where he's hanging on the cross. Of course that makes me sad. But this being bartered, you know, by an insightful crowd and having your life and knowing your life is slipping away from you. And to read these pieces of scripture that talk about all these different hearings just overwhelms me. So we're at trial number 7, and as I said, trial number 7 is Pilate saying, hey, you're innocent, but let's ask the people what they want, which is a mistake. So they say, of course, we want Barabbas, send us Barabbas and crucify Jesus. At that point, he's condemned, and Pilate delivers Jesus to be crucified at number 8 trial. 8 trials Jesus had. And in between those trials, he was flogged. He was cut. He was, you know, had a crown of thorns, you know, jammed on his head. So it wasn't just simply they were taking him from place to place. In between, they're torturing the man.
And humiliating him.
Yes. So here we are, you know, talking about an innocent man, the man that we know today, it, you know, that was grace promise to us being beaten and scorned while he's being transported to one person and another because they can't belly up to the bar and make a choice. Each one of these people are pawning him off because they don't want to make the decision. They don't want to be the guy that sent him to the cross. And especially Pilate, who ends up being the man who sends him to the cross. So I believe, mister.
It's my turn. And what's fascinating is what Jesus does next.
Yes.
He prays.
Yeah.
And he doesn't pray for himself first. He prays for the people. And he asks God to protect those that believe in him. And he asks that God keep them united in faith and belief so that they can stay one family. I'm not going to say much more than that because we're running out of time and there are other things that we need to get to. But what's so fascinating is that when Jesus is in trouble, he prays for other people because he knows that he's already made the decision to accept his fate and what God has asked him to do. So he prays then for himself to have strength to do what he needs to do. But he's more concerned about the people that come after.
Right.
And I think that's a beautiful thing. And I'm going to turn it back over to you, Judy.
Well, okay, fine. Because you're what?
Because we're going. We've got 7 minutes.
I got 7 minutes? Well, here
we
go.
Yeah, I haven't even got to the crucifixion yet.
Well, we're getting there right now. So, you know, we go through all these trials. He's condemned. He's turned over to be crucified. And, of course, they, you know, do ugly things to him. And they make him carry his own cross. A lot of people believe it's just the cross beam and not the whole cross. Either way, he falters because he's been beaten so bad. He falters, and of course, that's the story where Simon of Cyrene picks up the cross and carries it for him. And that's important because when you think about it, he didn't ask God to come down and help him carry that. He didn't say, hey, bring me an angel so I can, you know, make this easy. He continued with the unmerciful torture he was going through. Because you know and I know it could have been anything. So
I think it's important to note that he was a foreigner. He was not Jewish.
Right.
And often in the Old Testament, you see people, the ones that act the most heroic, who are following the Jewish law the best,
yes,
not Jews. And I think that's an important distinction to make.
Right. Absolutely. So Simon of Cyrene picks up the cross. Jesus makes his way to Golgotha. And at 9 a.m. on Friday, he is nailed to the cross and crucifixion begins. One of the things that moves me so much is that he's hanging on a cross with nails through his body. And what does he do? He prays and says, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Not, Father, will you bring a lightning bolt down and strike all these people and get me off this cross? You know, it's just the passion. And that's why I call it Passion Week. Passionate story. So he's asked God to forgive everyone who's killing his only son. And we're to the point where I think we need to stop here. He's on the cross. And our next show is going to be a wrap up of this and a focus on what does Jesus do after he's risen? You know, before he goes to heaven, there's a span of time that, you know, I don't think a lot of people know about.
That's right.
And I hope y'all weren't stymied by my silliness. You know, I may say silly things, but trust me, I am so serious when it comes to the Bible. So I say, Mr. Ryan, thank you very much. You're awesome as Robin. I love the costume.
I think next time I'd like to be Batgirl, though.
Batgirl? Well, now, her costume is kind of, you know,
a little tight for me.
Yeah. If you're going to be Batgirl, then I'm going to be Superman.
There we go. We'll both have a cape.
God bless and grace and peace.
Thank you so much for spending time with us this evening. Please come back again. And remember, be kind in all you do, and the kindness will come back to you. Grace and peace, Reverend Judy Hosner.